Good morning on Tuesday, November 17th, 2015. This is Brian Medden, and you are listening to a BrianMedden.com podcast. I am in my home in San Francisco. There's two other guys on the line today. We have Gabe Knuth joining us from Omaha, Nebraska. Good morning,
Hello.
Gabe.
Hello. Good morning.
And we have Michelle Roth joining us from the Netherlands. Hello, Michelle.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Yeah, good evening to you, I guess.
Good evening.
Michelle, I think a lot of our listeners probably know you. I mean, you've spoken at Briforum in the past. You've written a bunch of blog posts for us over the years, and kind of, gosh, I don't know. I probably first met you maybe at PubForum events in Europe. I don't know, 12, 13 years ago. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it must have been. I was actually thinking. I think it's over 10 years and. It's really scary because it means I'm getting old, right?
We look around us and we see people, you know, like Sean Bass is now in the CTO office of VMware, and we knew him when he was, you know, was speaking for the first time at Briforum in 2006, and you know, yeah. Ron Inglesby, all these people that we've known and we kind of grew up together, we've looked around and now they're all like, you know, executive level positions. Program managers and things like that, and you know we're still doing the same thing we've always
done. except for Gabe and Brian, who are just two jackass bloggers.
It makes you get to the age where you can start to make the joke. Well, back when I had more hair, right?
Oh my gosh, every day. We were bloggers before people knew what bloggers were. Then when bloggers were cool, and now nobody has blogs anymore.
but it's nice, and this is one of the things we can talk about today. You know, it gives us a sort of a different perspective on the industry. You know, 10 years ago, VDI was just starting to emerge as a thing. You know, 15 years ago, Citrix was new, and we were sort of younger and just excited about new technologies and excited about what things, you know, like change and all that kind of stuff. And over the past 15 years or so, we sort of evolved into recognizing that change, especially from an enterprise IT standpoint, is a giant pain in the butt. And we now don't like change. We look at these new technologies and say, okay, what can we do to actually be successful with this? And we don't want to go out and change the whole world and change the face of enterprise computing. We just want to, you know, make our users happy, keep on doing our jobs, and be left alone.
I think sometimes it could be perceived to be a little risky because we have the ability to look back, 15, 20 years, right? So we have a lot of context about how things came to be. But sometimes also wonder, you know, because we have this history, right? Maybe it kind of constrains you in thinking, you know, completely out of the box for something completely new, right? And I sometimes wonder if it's a constraint that we have, right? As a industry veterans, so to speak.
Well, and it's certainly something that when we were young, getting started in this, we looked at people like us and said that, you guys, you old guys don't understand, because we talked about, you know, Citrix and server-based computing in the late 90s. And, oh, it's this amazing thing. It's the future. This is the way Windows apps are going to deliver. And they were looking at us as like, you guys don't understand, you young kids. But I'm curious, you know, we talk about these, you know, 15 years, whatever it is, 20 years working in the industry. Michelle, one of the questions that we've asked people who joined us in the podcast, in today's podcast, we're going to talk about just general, you know, industry events and trends and that kind of stuff. But before we do, I'm always interested in, you know, how people got started in IT and with computers in general, you know? So you yourself, how'd you go from being a kid to, you know, first computer, getting into enterprise IT, all the stuff you do now? How'd you start with that?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting story in the sense that it may not be the most traditional aspect of it. So when I was growing up, I remember having this uncle, and it's really long ago. We had like a Commodore 64 and a nephew, I think, as well, that did amazing things with that computer. And I had no clue what they were doing. And frankly, I don't think I cared, right? Except for the games that I was able to play. So I really wasn't that into computers outside of like my Nintendo or something, playing a computer game every once in a while. And even in school, I don't remember being extremely interested into it. It was only when I guess, dropped out of the equivalent of college where I was doing biology, and then I dropped out of chemistry. I think the other way around, even. I can't remember all of my dropouts. I guess my parents, they, you know, they kind of forced me, saying, well, you know, you go figure out what it is you want to do, because, we're not keeping on paying for all of the stuff that you drop out on, right? So I think they kind of made me take this this test at like an agency, right? And they found out what it is that you want to do, right? And there were really stupid questions like, do you enjoy working with animals, right? Stupid things like that. But there were also some hidden questions in it, because when I got the test results, I got like a peek in chemistry, which is what I did. Then I dropped out. And I had the same peak for biology, which I also attempted, but wasn't for me. And then I had like a peak in IT. And I was going like, why? Why would I have a peak in IT? And I don't really care that much about computers, but I followed along anyway. And I went to doing some kind of network management course in a school where some of my friends were. And I liked it, and I was, fairly good at it. So I guess that's where my career path crosses with the career path that most people, or some of the people I know have, is I went into IT as a help desk person.
And that's mine. Yeah. That's where I think a lot of people started, right? Because I think it's where a lot of people started in the desktop virtualization world, because it takes a special kind of mindset to do this kind of thing, right? You have to be sympathetic to the end user experience. And so if you would have checked the box that says databases makes, I like databases, and they would have said, oh, you should be a database administrator, you never would have gotten a brush with the help desk. You would have just been with your head in books for the rest of your life.
I think it really helps. I think you're right. Yeah.
You're lucky that you didn't say that you really like to empty trash cans and things, because it might have been a completely different career path for you.
Yeah, well, I think that before that, and I remember, I don't know if this was parallel to my network administrator course school thing or before that, but via like some kind of a job agency, I was also offered an IT job, which the only part that was IT about it was it has something to do with computers, and it evolved around, I think this was like, cleaning up burnt computers. Really. So this was kind of like an insurance agency, and like there would be like a big fire in like an office building, and then a lot of computers would get smoke would get into the computers. I would clean motherboards with foam.
I don't think that's an IT job.
No, well, yeah, they said it's something with computers, and they lured me into it. Right? So I lasted 4 weeks there. But I did. It's on my resume. I did something with computers, right?
So that was back in probably the mid-90s, right, when you could say something with computers, and that sounded exotic to people.
Yeah,
because that's exactly. You talk about your uncle and your nephew, and my start was with my uncle, who was the guy that knew computers, and I'm using finger quotes, that was. If you asked anybody else in the family what my uncle did, it was something with computers. And I was the only one that cared to follow up on that and learn exactly what that meant.
Now, it's funny, though, that still applies today. I was at I was in Akron, where I'm from originally, this weekend. And I was at a bar watching the Browns game. And there was this old dude there. And we were just kind of talking. And he's, he had lived in San Francisco in the 70s, and he's a jazz musician and like went to Berkeley and stuff. And he's like, "You out in San Francisco?" And I was like, because my dad said that, I was out here, and he kind of said, "Yeah." And he's like, "So what do you do out there?
Where's this going?
what do you do out there? Something with computers?" And I'm just like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Yeah, good."
It's that generation, I think.
Yeah, but that was literally, that happened word for word 2 days ago. So.
So yeah, it's interesting. I feel like, we all definitely have some sort of user centric job when we first get into IT, and I think that's the case for almost everybody that does desktop virtualization today. So it's interesting to hear. It's just one more person, Michelle. You're confirming that this is, if you're a desktop virt person, you probably started on a help desk somewhere.
Yeah, Well, I truly, you know, not to protect my own resume or something, but I think it helps me, right? Because especially later when I became systems administrator and, you know, all the way across my career path, you know, it helps to understand even to the extent when you're in product management, right? You're thinking about what needs to be, in a given product or a desktop virtualization product, that, you know, it pays to know what the user goes through, right? So you also instantaneously know, you know, what things you don't want to have happen, right? So I remember, in one of the companies that I worked where I had discussions and, you know, we found out that something would add like 1.5 seconds to a logon or something, right? And some of the people would say, well, you know, what's 1.5 seconds? Who would notice? You go like, you know, go to the help desk and ask them, right? They will notice, right? Because they get the calls from angry employees or people using the system. So, you know, I think that in certain areas helped me, or, you know, with the, you know, performance of your desktop in general, or the way applications respond. So that I think that definitely helped me.
So let me ask you, you know, you mentioned product management, and, you know, you've been doing product management for various software companies for, I don't know, 10 years or 5 years, something like that. I've never worked for a company who had to create software. So I deal with a lot of product managers because, you know, it's all these vendors who are making new products in our space. You know, the product managers are the ones we talk to about new versions and features and roadmaps and all that kind of stuff. But I'm curious, what is life like as a product manager? Because, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of industry experience and you know what features you want in the products. Of course, your customers are going to request features that they want in the products. Your financial bosses want features that are going to sell the most new products. You know, engineering wants to add features that fix the most bugs of current, you know, customers. And then and then you've got, you know, the pissant bloggers like me and Gabe who are like, wouldn't it be cool if it did this? And the things we're saying are probably ridiculous because we have no actual customers.
But you still have to answer us when we say it.
But I mean, what is it like, especially, you know, being a technical person doing product management? I mean, that's just got to be, like, that's the reason you have, you know, your hair, you have less hair right now, right?
Yeah, it's a great question because I remember that before I went to product management, I think that, you know, to continue down that evolvement of roles, I think a pretty common evolving of roles if somebody that goes into product management typically comes from, like, from pre-sales or pro-serve, right? People with, like, a lot of, you know, market knowledge and customer knowledge that has the ability to, you know, to take in or see functional, you know, functional problems or requests that customers have. So I came from pre-sales. Like, the first mistake I made was that I was like, you know, I have a ton of ideas for cool stuff, right, that needs to go into our product, right? I could talk for 48 hours, for, you know, about all the cool things that need to go in. And then I guess product management reality hits you really hard because it typically, and this has been everywhere I worked, is that there's 1,000 good ideas, right? And it's up to you to pick the right one or two. And I guess that's what you were saying, right? How do you decide? And you know, it differs very much, you know, per company. You know, so sometimes there's a company that, you know, I won't name them, but because it exists everywhere. But some people go like, you know, whatever gets us in the magic quadrant of Gartner, right? Even if nobody's asked for us ever, if that's where we want to go, that's what we build to, right? That happens. We have people, I've worked with companies that are extremely customer focused, right? So, you know, if you have more than 10 seats, we'll build it for you, which I personally think isn't the best idea on the planet. But there's also, you know, there's the C factor, what I call it, right? So that typically when you see smaller companies where the founder is still there, or the CTO is still there, or, you know, somebody else that founded the company that has a very strong mindset about the product, that it goes like, well, it's great research that you did, but we're not doing it because we're doing my thing, right? you know, it's very real. And I think somewhere in there is the right mix. And I wish I had the answer to it, right? But obviously, as a product manager, I think that, you know, once you hire product management, you have to, you know, have these people decide, you know, what's the best mix of things to go into. And, you know, it's it's not one of those things that I mentioned, right? So it's a combination, right, of everything. And the best thing is that if you, as a company, right, which usually involves people above you as a product manager, you get a consensus around what it is that you want to do as a company, right? So maybe, you know, your CEO sets certain goals for the company. And then, you know, you reach a consensus with, you know, what's important, so what are our core objectives or our core strategies. And then you manage around that, right? And sometimes that evolves that you say we spend 10% of our time or 20% of our time, you know, creating functionality that existing customers ask for. We create 20% of things that we need to close strategic deals, right? Because, you know, unless you're Windows or, you know, or Google or Alphabet or whoever it is, if you're smaller, then you'll probably build something for a big customer, right? That's the reality of it. And you get some vision stuff in there, right, that may not make you money immediately, but maybe 3 years down the road. And maybe you do something for an analyst, and maybe you do something for a pissant blogger, right, just to keep them happy. And
no, that rarely happens.
Right? Well, you know, I have to say, right, it's a broken record at the companies I work with, but I usually go out of my way to make sure that we listen, right? We always listen. It doesn't mean that we do anything, but we definitely listen, and it goes into some kind of mental bucket to think about, but you know, it's a mix, and the mix always differs per company, right? I've had the privilege of doing that at a few companies already, and it's, you know, it's always different, and it's also the place where the company is, right? If it's a startup, I remember being at Provision. It's very different at a startup than it was at Dell when there was like 115,000 people, and it also, you know, the product maturity life cycle, right? If it's a product that's, you know, is it well established, right? Or is it trying to gain market share? So it's a very interesting job to be in. And, you know, one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and sometimes I can't help but getting on my, I guess you call it your soapbox, right? About, you know, product management specifically, that I think it's more of a, you know, a science, right? And there's an art, right? So if you get a lot of data, then you have the ability to make a good decision. And more importantly, you know, if there's somebody else in the room, highest paid person in the room or something, you have the ability to trump their opinion, right? Because you have facts. But still, it's a very dynamic role that sometimes is very fulfilling, and sometimes it's not that fulfilling, but it's the joys of being a product manager, I guess.
I imagine that, you know, you spend all this time with all the science and data and number crunching, and then there's all these little surprises that are thrown in, you know, especially if you're working in a smaller company who is in an ecosystem that's dominated by, you know, Microsoft, Citrix, VMware. You know, you could work on something and they release it and you got to sort of change your whole strategy very quickly, or you run into
scenarios they add the same feature that you have.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this feature you busted your ass for 3 years to make and perfect is now just, you know, a commodity that everybody has and nobody wants to pay for anymore.
Yeah. Go on.
I was going to say, you guys are spot on, right? So there's always your plan A, right? And then, but you also have to look out on the horizon and have a plan B. You know, if you're serious about product management, and you know, I think I can give you guys an example, which I think is public knowledge now, so it doesn't matter. But I don't know how long it was ago, but a long time ago, I worked at Login Consultants as a regular consultant, and that, then I joined Provision Networks, which was a really small company at the time. I think you guys wrote about it in the past as well.
Yeah,
we pretty quickly got acquired into Quest Software, right, which made the company go from 25 people, I think, to 3,500 people. And, you know, everybody I talked to, like, still today, right, it's vWorkspace now, but they said, it's a great product. Technically, it's a great product, right? That product has the ability, it's a good Citrix Compete product. At the time, we at least thought that it was the first real broker that existed, right? But you know, it's not only great technology, right? It's having great technology, and I guess it's executing the business model associated with that technology. And you know, to the example that you guys gave about markets changing, you know, the first big success, the biggest success that Provision had, or you know, V Workspace later, was you know, attaching to a Citrix sale, right? So most people ran you know Provision on VMware. I'm sorry, on VMware. And you know, as time progressed, at first you know VMware didn't care about VDI at all, right? If you Google really well, you'll find that you know they came into the VDI party a little bit late. But when they did, right, obviously, you know, they were less inclined to work with us. And, you know, the bulk of the IP that we had made was built, you know, for VMware. And, you know, we had to execute plan B, which was Hyper-V, right? And I think that, you know, I'm not that in the know anymore, but when I left, Hyper-V was still a very strong play for vWorkspace. And I think today that's still, you know,
that's still the case, right?
Adding, adding value to Hyper-V. So that's an example of, you know, basically plan B or looking at what your competitor slash partner is doing and figure out what to do next, right? And I'm sure all the companies that are in our space have a plan B. And if they don't have it, they should really quickly make it because, you know, even our small industry, goes very fast, right? We've seen, you know, Imidio, Cloud Volumes, RTO Software that went into VMware, RingCube, you know, lots of stuff go on in what's the space of, 2 years or 3 years or something?
A lot of these companies that you mentioned that, you know, get absorbed, the small companies get absorbed by bigger companies, and then that sort of causes the bigger company to change their tune. It's kind of funny because, you know, you'll hear, you know, a Citrix or VMware kind of minimizing or sort of poo-pooing some small, you know, fringe concept and saying, well, it doesn't really matter and our customers are not asking for it and stuff like that. And then overnight they buy one of these small vendors and all of a sudden it's all they can talk about how this technology is, you know, the future and all this kind of stuff. And from my standpoint, you know, the first time we saw this in our industry, I think, was maybe with like the layering or application sort of technologies, like when Microsoft bought Softricity. And Softricity started out as a very niche kind of terminal server only solution. And it was always sort of perceived as something that's kind of weird and different, and Microsoft didn't like it. And then I think it was, you know, it was almost 10 years ago that Microsoft bought Softricity and created AppV. And then all of a sudden, it's like, wow, this is actually something we need to start to pay attention to. And then we saw, you know, the evolution of application delivery and layering and all that kind of stuff. And so one small move like that can sort of shift entire industry. Even if the technology isn't that big of a deal, the fact that a big vendor buys them, it changes everyone's focus.
Yeah. I think to a certain extent, I may be wrong, but what could happen with layering, right? You guys talked to Kevin Goodman a month ago or something, like before that, and he has his own, you know, I call it layering company. Maybe it's the wrong description, but...
to Unidesk it is.
Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, I guess Citrix was first with RingCube, but, you know, and maybe it was because I had a little bit too much of an outside perspective, but they really didn't, you know, cash in on it or do a whole lot with it except for the personal vDisk thing. You know, then the whole Cloud Volumes with the VMware happened. And I think when I last counted, there's still like, you know, 7 or 8 of these layering companies that exist today and are in business. So, you know, that's always like, you know, writing on the wall, right? If there's so many companies making a living out of it, and if the big guys are focusing on it, then stuff is going to happen there, right? That's what I think.
You could argue, too, that VMware buying Winova was probably the first shot fired in there. I don't remember when that happened with regards around the same time as RingCube. But either way, I think that was the goal when they bought Winova. There's been a lot of activity there in the past. Yeah. But I think even that stuff, like what we called layering back then is not what people are calling layering today. Like I said, Unidesk, they do what I would call like traditional layering, but these other application layering is, I think, the name that is being the most, that's the most used name. It's really just about application management.
Yeah. I'm sure they'll all be called container something next year, right? Because that's the buzzword.
Right,
because
containers, yeah, for sure. And this is something I want to talk a little bit more about layering, because Michel, one of the things that, well, for those listening, we talked to Michel, I don't know, a few weeks ago, and talked about different ideas for articles. And Michel, you have written an article that we're going to be publishing soon that talks about the industry sort of mega trends. So these bigger trends of the industry, like layering, like hyperconvergence, you know, cloud security, and how these sort of big mega trends in the IT industry in general, how they specifically apply to the end user computing market. So it's an article I'm really excited about, because it sort of takes these big mega trends you read about everywhere and figure out how they affect us, essentially. And I'd like to talk about that kind of stuff, because you talked about that layering, I mean, it sort of caught a lot of people by surprise, right? Because, you know, application virtualization was around for 10 or 15 years, and it was kind of under the radar, as they say. And then all of a sudden, within the past few years, this whole layering thing just kind of blew up.
Yeah, it kind of caught me by surprise too, right? Because I was thinking that V has been around for the longest time, but like you guys said, right? I think although the technology had the potential to do the same thing, right? It was the use case was different, right? So that's what I mentioned earlier about, you know, you have technology, and then it depends on how you execute or, you know, have you go to market with that technology. And as early on as I can remember, that, you know, AppV, or, you know, Softricity, was about, you know, application virtualization, right? We had a terminal server, and then you had Access 97 on it. And then ta-da, you would show that it wasn't in the physical registry, right? I vividly remember that demo for somebody. and I also remember that, this is a good indication of it, because it also, you know, time is always a factor, right? If you're in products, you know, when you release something and how you release it is important. And the when, in this case, I remember the vision from Softricity, this David Gressler guy, I think. Mm-hmm. Was that Softricity was like, you know, applications stream to you, right? So it was like, I think they said they compared it to like power, right? You just plug in and you have power, and then, you know, if you have network, you have your applications. I think that's what their original pitch was, right? Way before Microsoft acquired them.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, that go to market didn't happen. But if you fast forward, what is it, like 15 years or whatever the number is, you have these guys from, I think they're Endeavors and Numescent now, or CloudHouse. They kind of do the same thing, right? So you have the application, and you have the ability to, wherever you are, you get that application to you, because they store the layer or the container or whatever they call it in the cloud, and then it comes to you, right? So it's the same functional result. It's just done differently and 15 years later.
And are you seeing this kind of thing catch on with actual customers? You know, there's, when we go to shows like VMworld and Synergy and Briarforum, you know, we see Numescent and, you know, CloudHouse, and we see, of course, you know, VMware buying Cloud Volumes and that kind of thing. So we see this kind of from the vendor perspective. Are you seeing customers actually sort of buying into this concept and starting to use these, you know, whatever you want to call it, layering cloud apps, you know, whatever. Is that something that's actually kind of catching on in the world?
Yeah, I think that the newer stuff, although I think Numescent has been doing the same thing for a little while now. I forgot what they call it, like Cloud Fabric or something like that. But I think Gartner coined the term, because, you know, it's Gartner, they have to coin the term. It's called Cloud Application Virtualization, which is where they place people like RingCube and Numescent, and I think they call TurboVM now or something, the old spoon.
Yeah.
I personally haven't seen that gain a whole lot of traction, but it's also relatively new. The other things like, you know, FSLogix or Unidesk, are more well-known, to me at least. And I think that's because, you know, they solve a tactical pain in an industry that I'm in, right? So it's in end-user computing / desktop virtualization. Layering helps, you know, make desktop virtualization easier, right, in a nutshell. And if you look at, like, the guys from a CloudHouse or from Numicent, they're not really, by definition, EUC people, right? They didn't come from the Citrix world or from the VMware world or from the whatever world, right? I think their story is more broad, and as a result, maybe that's also why I don't see them. But I think in general, there's not a huge amount of uptake. I think I read today that Numicent closed their second round of funding. I think they had like 13 million or something like that, which is great for them, but it's not like, you know, like they're the next Nutanix or something, right? So it's not exploding yet.
Nutanix, so that leaves, you know, you mentioned Nutanix. I mean, there's Nutanix and SimpliVity, and I think there's what's that one that's purple?
Cedo?
No. Anyway, there. So
I'm googling for purple app management.
No. Hyperconvergence.
Oh.
Why am I forgetting them? They started out. They're the ones that start out life as like doing security cameras. Do you remember that? And I'm completely forgetting them. They were right next to our booth at VMworld last year. but anyway, so the hyperconvergence is sort of another thing, you know, and Michel, that's something you talk about.
Oh, yeah, Pivot3.
Pivot3, yeah, thank you. Something you talk about in the mega trends. I mean, you know, Nutanix is just blowing up. I mean, in the good way of, you know, popularity. And they went from, you know, non-existence as a company, what, 5 years ago to, you know, they're giving the sort of traditional hardware vendors a run for their money. They're even making solutions now based on the open source KVM. So they're also giving VMware a run for their money. And, you know, I think this whole hyperconvergence concept, it works well for VDI, since VDI sort of traditionally has been is complex and sort of getting all your hardware set up and working and redundancy and performance and all that sort of thing. But I think this larger hyperconvergence trend, you know, has a big impact on us in the UC and VDI space.
Yeah, well, to be honest, right, that was, you know, when the first, you know, reports or, you know, the trends started to emerge about hyperconvergence, you know, I was always a little skeptical because, you know, when it starts with the word hyper, right, then, it must be some kind of a hype. But, you know, I think I learned, and it has a great place in my heart now, because, you know, I used to have this joke with an old colleague of mine, right, that, you know, back in those help desk days, right, I think we were two people on the help desk, and this one friend of mine, he called me the non-hardware guy, right, because whenever I would go to fix like a computer, like a user's PC, I would break it more than it was before, because I couldn't open it, or I missed a screw or something like that. So from that point on in my life, I wasn't the hardware guy, and, you know, today I'm still not a hardware guy. So the whole hyperconvergence thing is going like, yeah, you know, hardware, it's hardware.
That's that's always been our thought too.
Yeah. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, right, even if you look at the limited space of desktop virtualization, for example, right, you have to have hardware, right? And when people started to find out about, I wouldn't even say like the storage problem, but the storage knowledge you needed to do VDI, you know, successfully, for example, you know, it kind of became, you know, had to be part of your curriculum, right? You had to know something about it. You know how many IOPS you need and what the peak workload is and all that stuff. And, you know, when you think about it, that's just, it's wrong, right? I think I've sometimes compared it to the fact that, you know, it's like driving a car, but you have to be able to piece the engine together before you can go for a drive, right? Which is, you know, typically something that would make cars not very successful or cause more accidents in the road or anywhere in between.
So you mean it's wrong because, you know, the sort of traditional skill sets of what you need to be good at desktop virtualization are really Windows environment skill sets. So you know about application delivery or application installation and profiles and DLLs and registry and Windows security and all that kind of stuff. And then, and that's what you need to be a good Windows desktop admin, you know, same for the past 30 years.
Yeah, and then the hardware is just whatever the newest model was. You buy that.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then as soon as you add, started happening with Citrix and Terminal Server, but then once you certainly get into VDI, you know, now in order to be a good VDI admin, you need to know all of those Windows skills that you had to know for the past 30 years, but you also need to add all these sort of server architecture skills, and you need to understand about, you know, multi-processing systems and, you know, memory and disks and IOPS and all that kind of stuff. And so I guess your point is that it's wrong. I mean, it's too bad you have to learn all that stuff too. And I guess maybe that's the promise of hyperconverged, is that it lets Windows admins focus, or lets VDI admins focus on Windows, and they don't really have to worry about the hardware as much.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly, right? You want to, you know, probably your goal when you're going down a path like, you know, desktop virtualization is that you want to offer, you know, the end users a workspace. You know, that's great. It has the right applications, the right data, it's secure, all that stuff. And you don't want to care about, well, I'll probably need, like, you know, four SANs and 1,500 VLANs and, you know, whatever it is that you have to do, right? You just, you know, the stuff needs to run. And that's exactly why you're right. That's what made it tick for me, hyperconvergence, is that, you know, it just works, right? You don't really have to think about it.
I'm assuming we're having...
I think we lost
Skype connection.
The intelligence is in in the software. Oh, okay. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, it's you're breaking up a little bit there. We'll give it a shot. Okay. We can try. So the joke was before the show, you know, we connect to Skype via the computer, Michelle said, "Yeah, I was right about to use to make the call, and then my computer blue screened." Which it's funny, by the way. It's 2015.
Been there.
And that's still a thing.
I just blame Vista. Ever since the Geek Out in Amsterdam, where Vista crashed on our Geek Out game show
during
driver.
The game. Yeah.
Yeah, during the game. I just blame Vista. Every time I see a blue screen now, it's always Vista's fault, no matter what.
Michelle, is the hyperconverged, is that real? Are you seeing that? You know, people building VDI projects on hyperconverged infrastructure, and you think the hype, which, by the way, I never noticed the word hype and hyper. I think that's something that, as a non-native English speaker, you probably notice more than we do, those similarities. That's fantastic, though. I love that idea. But is it real? Do you think the hype of hyperconverged is justified, and people are actually seeing the benefit of it?
Yeah, I think so. Especially in the U.S., I think there's a bigger uptake. And as the bigger vendors get behind it, I think it will also become more of a commodity. I think, you know, today maybe cost might be a factor, right? Because obviously, as any good vendor, you'll make sure that your proposition has a great ROI or, you know, a low TCO. But I think it could maybe be a little bit cost prohibitive if you already have existing hardware, right? Which is what I guess most companies in the developed world have.
Yeah.
But I'm sure prices will get lower. And for new projects, it's I would almost say, you know, a no-brainer, right? Depending on the funding that you have for your project. But, you know, it just takes the guesswork out of the equation. And, you know, it's really easy to scale out and to scale up. And it allows you to focus on the stuff that, you know, as your Windows admin or VDI admin or architect, whatever you want, focus on that kind of stuff.
I wonder, do the big traditional server vendors have a play in the hyperconverged space? Because we have joked, well, it's not a joke, it's serious, that, you know, even these hyperconverged vendors, even though they're selling you a box, you know, they're not hardware vendors because, you know, Intel still makes the chips, you know, whatever, Micron still makes the SSD, whatever it is. Like, all they're doing is taking, and a lot of these cases, you know, the hyperconverged vendors, these boxes are assembled by Supermicro, who probably assembles all of the Dell and, you know, all those HP servers and stuff anyway. Do you think that these, you know, Dell, HP, and those folks go down that path? Because so far, you know, all the big traditional software or server vendors have said that they do hyperconverge too, but they don't really, and it seems like their solutions are a lot more expensive than what these sort of smaller startup type hyperconverged vendors do. I wonder if they end up buying these little companies and they just become, you know, the hyperconverged for the big vendors, or I wonder if they actually build their own software. I don't know. I'm just curious if like Dell and HP and these folks are going to get on board with hyperconverged as well.
Well, I think they, you know, and again, I'm not a hardware guy, right? But I think they are on board, or they claim to be on board, because they all have an offering that's at least labeled as hyperconverged. But I think it's mostly through partnerships, right? So, you know, Cisco does something with somebody, and then Dell does something with somebody. So they have an offering, right? They could be labeled as hyperconverged, but I think that, you know, the people that are truly in the hyperconverged area, like, you know, Nutanix or Atlantis or Pivot3.
So we lost you again,
be Supermicro who's creating everything. But, you know, they're definitely interested in it, that's for sure.
So sort of moving on beyond hyperconverged, you know, something else you talk about is the cloud. And, you know, certainly everyone understands the cloud is a mega trend. But one of the things I've always struggled with is how, quote unquote, the cloud applies to us in the EUC space. Because certainly we can look at these giant cloud vendors like, you know, AWS and Azure. And yeah, we can, you know, run Windows VMs in there, and we can put Citrix or VMware, you know, we can put Vue or Zen Desktop, Zen App, whatever, in those VMs. And then it's just, you know, my Citrix servers are running at AWS instead of my Citrix servers are running, you know, on my own building. But a lot of the sort of native cloud applications are not Windows desktop applications. You know, they are like web apps or backends for mobile apps and that kind of stuff. And I'm curious on your thoughts on how the mega trend of the cloud, how does that actually apply to us in the EUC space? Is it just DAS, or is there more than that?
Yeah, well, I think up until, what was it, a year ago, a year and a half ago, I think it was just, you know, desktops as a service, right? And I've always, you know, struggled with desktops as a service a little bit because, you know, there's a incredible economies of scale, right, by doing desktops as a service. But, you know, what we usually found was that it was great for a very limited use case, right? If you didn't have the application or data locality problem, because, you know, most, you know, larger companies, right, there's some homegrown app that needs to connect to some, you know, some database that either, you know, isn't movable to the cloud, or the customer doesn't want to move to the cloud, right? And then you end up with like this, like kind of half-assed solution, right? Where it's, you know, it's super fast to boot, right? And it's super fast to connect and super fast to scale up, but the application performance of the applications running inside that virtual desktop, you know, sucks because, you know, you're going from your company network, you know, to the cloud to get to your desktop, and then in the cloud desktop, you go back to your own infrastructure to connect to the database or something like that, right? So I think that's a problem that's plagued, you know, desktops as a service, in the sense that it might have prohibited to go, you know, really big. But I think that over the last couple of, you know, it's the last year or something like that, we've seen a little bit of an uptake. So I think, I guess the first variation were, you know, the was Microsoft when they had Azure Remote App. I think they talked about it a whole lot earlier than they actually shipped it. But I think it's been in the market for almost a year now, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, kind of like DOS a little bit, right? Because it's still an RDSH server running in the cloud. But I think they pitch it more around the application, you know, and as a result, you know, you can take it on a per application basis. And if that application doesn't have the data or application locality problem, then, you know, that helps. But I think what will have an even bigger impact is what Citrix and VMware are doing with their, you know, quote-unquote cloud propositions, which is Citrix Workspace Cloud and the upcoming project Enzo by VMware. And that's because they don't forget about the on-premises stuff, right? I think that's the key thing that sets both Citrix Workspace Cloud and Project Enzo apart from all the other things that are happening, because it basically gives you like a hybrid, you know, hybrid cloud model in the sense of desktop virtualization, right? I know Enzo hasn't shipped yet, but from what I know of it is that, you know, it serves on-premises purposes as well as, you know, running your application and desktop workload in the cloud, right? So once you have that, then I think it becomes a lot more appealing, you know, purely from a technology perspective for customers, right? I know you guys feel a certain way about the pricing, I think, that Workspace Cloud has. But, you know, if you just look at the technology, I think that really has has the ability to go somewhere. And that's probably also why, you know, I think Citrix and VMware are betting big on that. That has the potential to go somewhere because it doesn't ignore your existing stuff.
And then once you've found a way to move some of that existing stuff that's preventing desktops as a service from taking off, you know, the where the application data lives, the data locality and things like that, as you chip away at those and move those to the cloud, you can then shift those workloads from local to the cloud using Workspace services or Workspace Cloud, I guess now, or Enzo. You can just transition to that seamlessly rather than having to dump everything you currently do and move it all to the cloud, which I agree 100%.
Yeah, and 'cause I think that's the fundamental, you know, we've written about this certainly over the past few years, is that I'm such a believer in the concept of DAS, and I'm a believer in the concept that a big dedicated DAS provider is able to do VDI more reliably, more securely, and less expensively than any, except for the very largest companies, could do on their own. So it makes sense. DAS makes sense if you're looking at, you know, not DAS to replace all traditional desktops, but I think DAS theoretically makes sense to replace all on-premises VDI. But of course, the catch is the fact that, you know, it's not just moving your desktops to the cloud. It's, as you were saying, Michelle, you know, as soon as you move your desktops in the cloud, now do you move a domain controller into the cloud too, so they can authenticate faster, and so they can, you know, do all their group memberships and all that stuff and access faster? But then do you move your applications? You know, you need this file server in the cloud. Now you need this database server in the cloud. Now you need this application server in the cloud. And if you move those in the cloud, now the ones that are left on premises, how about those users who are left? Are they accessing it from the cloud? It gets really complex. And so I guess this, you know, I think that's why we have not seen DAS as sort of the cloud solution for enterprises. But yeah, this hybrid stuff, I mean, you're right. You know, the Citrix Workspace Cloud pricing is about 10 times higher than it maybe should be. But in terms of core technology, I like that approach of being able to sort of move the bits that make sense to the cloud while leaving the bits that should be on-premises actually on-premises.
Yeah. And I think because I mean hybrid in the biggest possible form, because, you know, what I've also learned, you know, over the years, is that although, you know, desktop virtualization is, you know, has a lot of places where it makes sense, there's also, you know, a much larger amount that for whatever reason doesn't make sense, right? So I think that, you know, VDI and server-based computing maybe get to, what, 10% or 50% of all managed computers in the world, right? And I think the vendor that finds a way to also, in an intelligent fashion, you know, allows you to also manage traditional, you know, PC or whatever they call it, deployments, right? Or not only deployments, right? You know, the application delivery or the data delivery part of that. If they really nail that, I think that's the key thing, right? Because realistically, this is, you know, look at it from a vendor perspective, right? You're trying to get 10% of this, you know, this total PC market, but there's another 90% out there, right? That's I think it's for the SCCMs of the world and people like that. But yeah, it makes total sense, right? It's, you know, it's end-use computing, and then, you know, if you look at it realistically, most of that is non-virtualized desktop, right? It's just plain old boring desktops.
You know, and of course the other aspect of everything to the cloud you sort of touched on is the security element, where you know, I think a lot of people nowadays are on board with the concept that a cloud provider can provide good security, perhaps better security than what an on-premises solution can be. And, you know, we saw things like with Microsoft Azure partnering with Deutsche Telekom. So, like, for Azure in Germany, you know, Deutsche Telekom is sort of the custodian of the data, so that it's not controlled by Microsoft, it's controlled by Deutsche Telekom, which meets all the German regulations, and it's, you know, the data is guaranteed to be in-country and all that kind of stuff. But of course, security is such a generic concept. You know, you can't just go buy some security. It means a million different things to, from a million different angles. And so I think a lot of people who are nervous about security, it's not that the cloud providers aren't secure, so to speak. It's just that, well, if I put, you know, part of my infrastructure at one location and part of my infrastructure on another location, I have to think about, you know, authentication and access and rights management and, you know, control and all that sort of thing. And I feel like this sort of the security aspect of this is the big unknown that is causing a lot of people to hesitate when they think about, you know, changing where their infrastructure and data actually lives.
That's just it too, because there's a lot of, you know, the providers can say, oh, look, we've achieved all these different certifications. And so while on paper they may qualify as an acceptable provider, there's either too many moving parts or, like you say, too many unknowns, just in terms of handing over the keys to somebody else. And there's as many mental blocks as there are technical blocks. It's funny, we wrote that book in, what, early 2014, and I don't think anything has changed really in terms of the mindset towards any of this stuff.
No, the DAS book, I mean, yeah. No,
yeah.
I don't know, is that a thing, like, you know, because we tend to look at security, and I say we in the end user computing space, you know, we look at security through the lens of Windows desktop. So we're thinking security like, oh, user doesn't have admin rights and user can't, you know, access network shares they shouldn't access. But it's so much more than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, security as a term is almost even vaguer than cloud, right? But it's also, I guess, you know, it's something that people just, you know, it's supposed to be invisible, right? They just expect it to be there. And a lot of those discussions, like about security of using cloud-based services, right? I think arise, like you said, around the security of their cloud provider themselves, right? Are they looking after my stuff I put in your, you know, on your server in your cloud? But I think, you know, realistically speaking, the, you know, most of the vulnerabilities exist like inside the good old on-premises stuff, right? Because I think there's almost like a false sense of security that people might have, in the sense that, you know, they go like, well, this is all running in my network, right? And I have this firewall thing and I have the firewall guy that takes care of everything. So, you know, we're good. But, you know, I have no data for this, which is, I'm a bad product manager. But I think if there was any data about it, I think you'd see that, like, the threats are now, you know, come from a couple of areas. I think one is that there's, because of the uptake of, you know, cloud services, especially in larger companies, and the amount of, you know, connectivity that we have all the time from different devices makes it so that there's so much data going out of your enterprise that that's the stuff you should be worried about, right? It's, you know, the things getting in, I think we've covered it, right? There's the firewall and we block stuff and we only allow AT and 443 going out, you know, the traditional firewall stuff. I think that's, you know, almost every modern enterprise is that covered. But I think, you know, people should worry about stuff going out, right? I think for a couple of reasons. So for one is that, you know, you may lose some IP, right? Which I guess is very important. But if you think about it, if you look at security in that sense, you know, all bad things that happen to your network, right, whether it's a virus or a ransomware or a Trojan or whatever you call it, they all have one thing in common, right? They all go outside of your network to phone home or to spread or to, you know, book money somewhere. So I think that's where a lot of security to be found, right, by analyzing what goes out of your network. And I think they you know, not very little, but, you know, it's not as common as blocking incoming. I was recently reading about, you know, market sec. Okay.
Sorry, we lost you there? Yeah, we lost you again. And I think just as you were.
The one thing you need to remember is.
Yeah, you're coming to your point. But
never do. Yeah.
But, you know, you were saying about that. I don't know if you can repeat what you said in the last 30 seconds about. You know, it's you're talking about the security of stuff going out, you know, that was an issue.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of upcoming vendors, right, that focus just on that, right? I think they call them cloud access security brokers. I think one was acquired for like 380 million or whatever number is, Elastica, they were called. But they focus on, you know, securing the stuff that goes out, right? They do, you know, heuristics, they monitor the traffic, and, you know, part of it is for security, part of it is to guard your IP or to monitor how much cloud services are being used. So I think that's a big portion of it. And also, you know, just the things that happen inside your network. You know, I think this year, unfortunately, there's been a bigger amount of hacks than there were ever before. And I think, frankly, that's because, you know, cybercrime is professionalizing, for lack of a better word, right? There's more cybercrime, and they're getting better at it. And I don't think, you know, most companies, you know, act on it, right? I don't think imagine if cybercrime increased to 25%, they go like, oh, we need to up our security budget to 25%, right? They just keep doing, well, we have antivirus, right? We have a firewall. We're good. So I think that will have a big impact. And also, unfortunately, the other stuff that's happening in the world, right, you know, cybercrime because of political reasons or, you know, or religious reasons, you know, is also taking off. And I was reading this one thing that the cybercrime budget for the U.S. for next year, I think, is $14 billion or something like that. So you can bet that that's going to, you know, creates some mind share, and, you know, wherever the money is, the vendors will surely follow. And I think customers will have to, right? Will have to do something with security. And if that's the case, I'm sure, you know, also the vendors in our space, well, they'll probably follow, right? So maybe Citrix or VMware will, you know, announce something around security. I know VMware has a certain play in NSX, but it's probably bigger than that. And I would think that they would do something in that space.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you look at security from the desktop virtualization standpoint. You know, we talk about, yeah, we can be good at blocking, you know, having firewalls and only allowing traffic in via 443 to our specific brokers and that kind of stuff. But then what we deliver to them is a Windows desktop, which then essentially has, in a lot of cases, unlimited access to the backend networks. And so this whole idea of securing every single, you know, connection that desktop makes back into its infrastructure, that's what needs to happen. But that is certainly, I mean, that's just such a harder thing to secure. It's not as easy as just blocking all traffic except for 443.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a science on its own, right? Because, you know, it's basically looking in depth at the traffic that's going out, because, you know, these cybercrime people, you know, from what I hear, you know, they're really good, right? So it's not like you see, well, oh, the header has, you know, exploit something in it, right? It's just, it's perfectly legitimate traffic, except for the fact that, you know, it's going to the same bank account in some country, right? Every 14 minutes or something like that. It's you know, they're really good at it, and it requires a mindset. And if you think about it, the other common denominator is that this illegal activity happens from
Well, we've lost him again.
You, you're saying
if I hack you from something like that, you know that. Yeah, it you're probably the point I'm making is that the platform that's hacked probably most likely is the good old Windows platform, right? Just a physical PC that somebody happens to be working on and he has no idea it's being hacked, right? That's also the stuff we manage, I guess, with the end-user computing solutions that are out there in the market.
And that's one of those things, too, that wasn't ever in our base skill set, too. You know, so now, you know, now we have to be hardware people, we have to be storage people, and we have to be security people to some degree that we never had to be before. And it's, and then, you know, of course, at the same time, we have to find the balance of security versus usability, too, because, you know, surely we can lock them all down, but then if they can't do their job or if it becomes too much of a encumbrance to doing their job, then do we back it off or do we say, sorry, this is the way it is because it has to be secure? And that's a tough decision. And I think a lot of companies just choose to not act at all, and that's dangerous as well.
Yeah, until it's too late, right? And then they go online and say, oh, we leaked 150 million credit card numbers. But the logons were very fast.
So we're sort of out of time, but the, you know, one thing I want to ask you, though, just finally, is Windows 10. I've been asking everyone this. What do you see? You know, most IT professionals, I think, like Windows 10, are excited about Windows 10. With customers you're talking to, are you seeing, are people starting to build their Windows 10 plans? Are they doing mass migrations to Windows 10? Are they going to do a mass migration? Is it going to be a step-by-step migration? You know, I'm just sort of curious. Like, what are you seeing out there with regard to Windows 10?
Yeah, well, I definitely I've seen interest in Windows 10, right? You know, like probably like 100 times more than there was in Windows 8. But you know, even if you know, and personally, I like Windows 10, right? I think I tweeted the other day because I haven't been using it for that long, to be honest. But I said the longer I use Windows 10, you know, the more amazed I am that Microsoft had, you know, dared to release Windows 8 the way they released it, right? Mm-hmm. which says a lot about both, I think. But we, you know, there's a lot of interest in people that that I meet. But you know, it's still a new version of Windows, right? So if it's a new project, I think people are a lot more confident to go with it. But you know, it's not like switching a knob, right? In the end, it's about applications and data and you know, application compatibility specifically. So you know, it will take some time, but I definitely see a lot more people moving and acting on Windows 10. Although there's this you know, very interesting thing about you know, the Windows as a service, right? I think we have yet to learn how the larger companies of this world deal with the fact that you know, you're getting a new feature. Whether you like it or not, here it comes. Yeah. You know, you won't know exactly what it is. You won't know exactly when it will be. All you know is that the operating system that you're using to run all of your business critical apps will change, right?
And that's what a lot of people are waiting for, is to for that. I asked at a show that I did a few weeks ago of you know what their plans were, and a person raised his hand and said, "I'm waiting for the first service pack, just like always." And what he meant was, you know, that not they don't have service packs anymore. It'll be the long-term servicing branch that, you know, yeah. I don't know if there's the first one has been released yet for Windows 10 or not. But you know, so they're waiting for that, and they kind of want to see, A, they want it for reliability, but they also want to just see how this whole thing works because, you know, so you go to this one long-term servicing branch, and then when the next one comes out, you have a choice to either move to that or to move to the other branch, the one that's updated every month or whatever. And people are just, yeah, they're waiting to see how that whole thing works because you're right, they don't want to get surprised by these more forced updates. I think it'll be fine though. I haven't heard anybody that's actively avoiding Windows 10 yet.
No, well, it's going to be interesting, right? Because if you, I'm not sure if the Microsoft changed the lingo around it, but if you look at the way that Microsoft positions LTSB, they go like, this is for mission critical things like ATMs or you know, heart rate.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I had not seen that. Right. Well,
not
I know a lot
typical
of people are waiting.
Enterprise PC, so I'm curious to see. Yeah.
This may be one of those things where the enterprise just does what the enterprise is going to do, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. Jack we'll see just posted that the next major business branch release just came out. Yeah, it's interesting because that's the challenge for Microsoft is they want to move to this continually updating, you know, no real Windows versions. Everything is just always up to date. And that's kind of like what happens in the mobile space. Yet businesses by definition want to have more stability, and that's why they have their, you know, long-term support versions. But it's kind of like, in order for a business to adopt Windows 10, Microsoft has to specifically not do the thing that they're doing, that they're betting the future of the company on. Well, I guess I can summarize. You know, we have, you know, so we've all on this call been in the industry for 20 years, and our jobs are not done. You know, the idea
Your job as a Windows and desktop and application manager, product manager in the Windows and desktop application space is completely safe.
Jack's saying now in the tweet, in the chat, that the business branch is separate from the long-term support branch.
It's separate from the consumer branch. And so the business branch release that just came out is like the first major business branch update or release that came out after Windows 10 was RTM'd. And so we still haven't seen an LTSB like snapshot of that yet. So that there'll be a couple more of these updates before they certify one as LTSB. Where they'll basically, it's just like the LTS builds for Linux, like where they'll support that for a long time. So this is still basically an interim update. And so eventually we'll see an LTSB for the enterprise.
So there's two branches, like consumer and business, and they're both updated a lot. Maybe the business branch is not updated as much as the consumer branch, but then
they have said as much as that. Like they test out things on consumers first. So good luck with that.
And then the business branch will be like, you know, the more like more well tested version of regular Windows 10 that's updated more often. But then every so once, maybe once a year, or whatever, they'll now say, okay, here's our long term branch, our long term support snapshot that we'll support for, you know, 5 years or whatever.
And you can choose then to deploy updates that come out in the meantime to that LTSB. But then by the time the next one comes out, they're going to expect you to go to that.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
It's almost a whole separate discussion, right? Because also as a vendor, right, it's interesting, right? Imagine if you test a basically just like a customer, right? There's a new service back. Oh, let's make sure that everything that we have still worked, right? But now, you know, there's more alternatives than the service pack, right? So you have to be able to service a customer that's on the fast ring, right, on the consumer update speed, or on the business branch, or an LTSD branch, right? So at a lot of, you know, vendors, right, their QA mechanism or their certifying of a given release of Windows is out the window, right? They have to reinvent the way they do that, and they really have no choice.
Yeah. Yeah, so this really is the last version of Windows in terms of it will be called Windows 10 forever, but it is definitely not the last
So there's going to be Windows 10 2018 edition. All right.
Right.
Yeah, fun. So, all right. Well, hey, Michelle, it was fantastic to kind of catch up with you. I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today and kind of share these articles that you've got coming up. I'm really looking forward to reading the stuff that you'll be writing for us. So we've got there's a bunch of stuff we talked about today will be future articles on BradMadden.com. So, yeah, thanks for your time today.
No problem. My pleasure.
I guess, you know, all of you for listening, thank you so much. Gabe, thanks. Yep. Justin, our engineer, Mariah, our cat herder. Thanks, everyone. And we'll probably be gone. Next week is Thanksgiving here in the U.S., so we'll probably be back in a few weeks to continue more of our...
Oh, good. We're not going to do the Things We're Thankful For podcast.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you right now, I'm thankful for... I'm thankful that, you know, 20 years into this, there's still... We're no closer to solving the ultimate solution, you know. My job is secure for the next 20 years, which is nice.
Yeah, thankful for every acquisition and rumored acquisition.
Yeah. Thank you, thank you, Elliot. Thank you for giving me stuff to write about. All right, guys. Hey, thanks a lot, everyone, and we'll talk to you all in a few weeks.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving.